If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Levi's, Plow & Hearth, Adidas, Sephora, and Neiman Marcus. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. And it's easy to use. And you get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's R-A-K-U-T-E-N. Rakuten.com.
You're listening to the Common Fan Podcast, a Husker football podcast for the common fan by the common fan.
Welcome back to the Common Fan Podcast. I am TJ Burkle, as always, with Matty Owens Sr. and Geoff in Lincoln. Get to the Common Fan website, www.commonfan.co. Fall camp is right around the corner, Common Fans. It's basically upon us. The season is right around the corner. The Nebraska football team will play a game next month. You got to get to the Common Fan website. You got to get signed up. You got to get following all the social media accounts, commonfan.co. Get yourself game ready. You don't want to get game ready the day before the game. You got to start preparing now. So get to the Common Fan website, follow all the social media accounts, subscribe on YouTube, sign up for the newsletter, and let's get ready to rock and roll. You also need to get your Common Fan socks. As we get into fall, it's going to get colder. You're going to want as many Common Fan socks as you can get. Go to sillesco.com, S-I-L-L-I-E-S-C-O.com. Use the promo card code GBR for life. That's GBR number four, L-I-F-E. That'll get you 25% off any sock on the site. But make sure you pick up your Common Fan socks while you're searching all the other colorful socks on the site. Whew! Had a hard time getting that out.
That's a lot.
Gentlemen, we're back where we started.
Yes.
We're back where we started with the TO series. And in fact, Geoff, you're going to love this. It was T.S. Eliot who said, "We shall not cease from exploration. And the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time."
And might I also, if a tree falls in the woods and no one's around, can you hear it?
What?
Thank you, Geoff.
Philosophical.
I would welcome back Henry Cordes and Brandon Vogel to the program. Gentlemen, how are we?
Great. Yeah. No, I've really enjoyed, you know, we were part of what? Episode number one. And
episode one of the TOS.
I really enjoyed the entire series. And in fact, I learned today that one Tom Osborne has also listened to at least part of the series.
No way.
What? You don't say.
Don't you talk like that. I can't believe it.
We were fairly certain he'd been listening for a while, going back to the belly G option in 2023. Yeah. If we're being honest, we won't get into all that whole backstory. Well, that's very cool. That's awesome to hear.
That's great.
And Henry, Brandon, you've been on with us many times. Brandon, you probably have the record of the most number of appearances. But Henry, this is your second time. You've officially reached friend of the program status. So congratulations.
Oh, wow. No. What an honor. Thank
Bravo.
You.
Bravo.
No, thank you, guys. It's been, for those of you Common Fans who are just stumbling upon this episode and you're not aware, we just spent five episodes going through really Tom Osborne's entire coaching career. So the first one, we had this motley crew together and kind of talked through T.O.'s time as an assistant in the 1960s and his promotion to offensive coordinator. Looking at his time as a head coach in the 70s, we talked to Mike Babcock and Husker legend Tom Rude. Looking at his fantastic teams in the 80s, who were tantalizingly close to two national championships. And we talked to Steve Taylor and Ken Hambleton. And then so much happened in the 90s. We split up the 90s into two episodes, where the early 90s through the first national title in 1994, we talked to Mitch Sherman and Abdul Muhammad. And then for the end of his coaching career, 95 to 97, we talked to Tom Chattel and Grant Wistrom. Every single one of these episodes has been thoroughly enjoyable. Our guests have been made fantastic contributions, and we appreciate it. And we wanted to do one more episode simply because, guys, I mean, we got to the end of that episode with Tom and Grant, and we covered so much ground, but it felt like, geez, we got to stop and breathe a little bit and reflect a little bit, I think, on sort of the legacy of the man at this point and what he contributed and what he means to Nebraska football and to college football. And so looking back at the episodes, I think some themes start to emerge, right? I mean, it's funny because he's so stoic. And by the time we were growing up, I feel like national media would even call him boring. He's actually one of the most sort of open-minded and innovative coaches I think college football has ever seen. And so, you know, we talk about open-mindedness, willingness to adapt, convincing Devaney to hire Boyd Epley when no one in the country was doing strength training, offensive innovation from his earliest days as offensive coordinator, expanding recruiting to have a national reach, the defensive overhaul in the early 90s we talked about on more recent episodes. I mentioned his ingenuity, and just we've talked on multiple episodes about how he flat out outcoached multiple coaches in multiple games and predicted things before they happened, right? That actually ended up happening. And that ingenuity combined with his just tireless work ethic made him a formidable opponent. So work ethic is another piece of this. And of course, consistency. So Grant talked about that in particular through adversity and even tragedy. He was always steady as a rock. And I think the final thing that comes to mind for me is how beloved he was by his players. So there's a lot to say, a lot to talk about. Let's start with Henry. What would you say is Tom Osborne's most enduring legacy?
Well, I mean, not to make it too complicated, I think his most enduring legacy is he's one of the greatest football coaches of all time, certainly one of the greatest college football coaches of all time, that I probably of all football coaches. I mean, you just look at that record, you know, you start with the fact he won 255 games in 25 years. The math for that isn't too complicated. You know, it was more than 10 victories a year. And then he only lost 49, which again, the math isn't that complicated. That was slightly less than two losses per year. And that's what he averaged. And then if you go to coaches who won at least 200 games, in major college, he has the highest winning percentage of them all, and it's not even close. Nick Saban is a very distant second to him on that. Now, we'll probably talk about Nick Saban some too. And even more amazing than just that sheer record was just the consistency of it. I mean, how he never failed to win at least nine. He never failed to go to a bowl. He never failed to finish at least in the top 20 of at least one of the polls. And then my favorite consistency statistic of them all is that he only once in his whole career lost to a team that finished with a losing record. And bonus points if you can guess what that game was. I mean, just amazing consistency, just a great coach, you know, truly one of the greatest of all time. But that said, I think there is a legacy beyond football, and I think that gets to what a cultural phenomena football is in this state. You know, football truly binds us together from Omaha to Scotts Bluff. It's a great source of pride. And while I think the roots of that were under Devaney, you know, we know they were selling out under Devaney, but I think it was under Tom that culture really flourished. We all, you know, all of us grew up with a belief, you know, that Nebraska was going to be competing for a national championship this year. I mean, it became an expectation. And more than that, there was a culture around the program that he built that was that the a culture that the people really embrace, that this idea of win, not only winning, but doing it the right way. You know, we win the right way here at Nebraska. We took a lot of pride in rooting for a team that had a lot of local kids on it, hardworking kids. The players graduated. We even applauded for the, you know, losing fans or losing team when they left. And I really trace a lot of that entire culture of football that we grew up with. I mean, it was deeply rooted in Tom's character. And so I think it really did go beyond football. And I mean, he really made football part of this state's very DNA. And in that way, I think he wasn't just an important football coach. I think he becomes one of the most important historical figures in Nebraska history. I really don't think it's a stretch to say that.
That's a great call. I would love to get Brandon's take on this as well. Was it Iowa State in 91?
92.
92, exactly.
Marv Seiler?
Yes. Yeah. freshman Tommy Frazier at the control. Yes.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Sorry, Brandon, thoughts on the legacy question?
Well, that sends me back. That was also my thought, because I distinctly remember being at a wrestling meet in Alliance, Nebraska, not because I was wrestling, but just supporting my friend and like hearing updates as they murmured through the crowd of like, oh, Nebraska's losing to Iowa State. And it was just unthinkable. And Henry's point is great, I think, in that kind of Tom Osborne's approach and his demeanor in some ways has come to define what we think of when we think of Nebraska football at its peak level, and in some ways trying to get back to that. You know, when I kind of considered this question, I chose to focus mostly on kind of the leadership part of it. And if I had to boil it down, and I'm trying to keep this pretty general because I believe we'll probably get into some of these things later. He was a coach who wasn't afraid of the hard decisions, which might seem simple, but I think it's actually hard. And I think it's actually the key to kind of unlocking that elite level. I would classify Tom Osborne as an egalitarian leader, somebody who was not like, this is the plan I have laid out. I am not accepting feedback. I don't need that. He valued his assistants. He valued his players. And that's good. Like, that can get you really far ahead in college football just by doing those two things. But I think the next level is knowing when you're at a decision point where you're the head man, this is my choice, and not being afraid to make those calls. And when you look at his career, I think there's two big examples. There's the 84 Orange Bowl decision, which doesn't go his way, but proves to be, I think, defining in a good way for how he's remembered nationally from that point on. And there's the Lawrence Phillips incident, which is in some ways kind of the opposite of that. And in both of those cases, when I thought about this in a big picture sense, he didn't take the easy way, I would argue. And in some ways, when I think back about all 25 of those years as kind of the full book, that's kind of the theme that emerges for me, is not taking the easy way. And in some ways, I think his career trajectory kind of supports that idea.
It definitely took some chances. One thing, Brandon, we're the common fans, all right? Using words like egalitarian, we don't know what that means, okay?
Speak for yourself, Jeff.
Jeff, we've now had both Leo Tolstoy and T.S. Eliot quoted on this podcast, so we're upping our game.
Yes, we have.
We're common fans, but we're also thinking fans.
There we go, yep.
Exactly.
Well, some of the stuff that both of you guys said, I think, leads to the next question pretty well. I would argue that Tom was a little bit ahead of his time in his approach to how to handle players and how to handle people. You know, now you there's not that many of the old school, you know, verbally abusive coaches, you know, the way there was in the 60s, 70s, 80s. So I would argue he's a little bit ahead of his time, but you know, also knowing that he does have quite a background in education, I mean, he has a PhD in educational psychology. So let's start with Henry. Henry, how do you see how that showed up in his coaching style?
Well, I just, it was something Brandon said that made me think about this. It's, you know, he truly believed in the net worth of every individual, and nobody was expendable to him. And we saw that time and again, you know, and compare that to today's college football. Yeah, we don't have, you know, coaches out there yelling at players anymore, but we have coaches that will cut a player, you know, to clear a spot, you know, on the roster. We have coaches who will think nothing of, you know, using their players to, you know, and playing injured players to try to win, and coaches who will think nothing about, you know, turning tail and going to another school and leaving their players behind. Tom would never do those things. It was really rooted in the fact that he deeply cared for the people he was working with, including his assistant coaches. He didn't go around firing assistant coaches when things were going bad. He just inherently believed in the value of all people. And that, I mean, I guess that's partly an education thing, but I think it's deeper than that too.
Brandon, you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I had some very similar thoughts, actually. It kind of sends me back. I've never spoken with Tom Osborne about kind of his background in education and what it may have meant. Like, there's no specific technique for me to point to and be like, oh yeah, he was just using that because he learned that. But I will say, you know, his plan was to be an educator before he became a football coach. And there's a lot of college football coaches out there with advanced degrees, because that's just kind of where you go. Like, you got to, like, a lot of people start as a GA and you're supposed to be getting a graduate degree. With Osborne, I always got the sense that, like, it actually kind of informed everything that came after. And one of the examples that jumped out to me was just kind of the four station practice, which has become a thing as Nebraska's fortunes have, you know, fallen below what they were during the Devaney and Osborne years. In some cases, unfairly, in my mind, it kind of became a cure-all of, like, oh, there's guys just standing around, they're not practicing. But kind of to Henry's point, I think the underpinning of that was valuing everyone, of like, these players are here, and in this instance, I really treat them more as students. So let's teach them. Let's teach them all, because they all deserve an opportunity. And yeah, if you want to take a more cynical view, you'd be like, well, Nebraska had 180 guys on those rosters or whatever the numbers were. You're just taking swings on these walk-ons. But you don't know if those walk-ons can eventually become All-Americans if you don't coach them. So that was one of the things that stood out to me, specifically as it related to education, because it's not that different than teaching anything else, if you're committed to it.
And he didn't just value the walk-ons who went on to become starters. He valued the walk-ons that served as practice fodder, mm-hmm. because he knew that without those guys, he couldn't practice the way he wanted to. He couldn't hold four station practices. And he made a point of, well, first of all, he recruited the walk-ons himself. And number two was, he made a point of getting to know them just as much as he made a point of getting to know the star players that he recruited from all corners of the country. When I first started Unbeatable, I sat down with Tom and I said, I know where this book is going to begin, Tom. It's going to begin at a fall practice before the season in 1994. Put me at that practice. And it was absolutely amazing because that's where I learned about the four station practice. I had not heard anything about this. And he talked me through the entire system of how he ran a practice. And it was unbelievable. And one of the things was, before he went to practice, he would go sit down in his office and review the files of like, he'd make a point. I'm going to talk to these three or four kids today. And he would look at that. He'd remind himself, you know, the names of their parents. You know, people think, oh gosh, you keep me remembering my parents. It was a part, a studied thing, but he wanted those players to know he cared about them and they were valued. And he had 180 players to remember. And these are not the kids he's talking to every day. So he couldn't pull it off all out of his head, but he made a point of connecting with those kids. And, because those are the ones that, you know, enabled his system to work.
So I'm glad that you said that, Henry, because you said when it came to education, it's deeper than that. And you kind of jumped into the next question I was going to ask is specifically connecting with players, because we've had Abdul Muhammad on, Steve Taylor on, Grant Wistrom was on. And the one consistency with a lot of those former players is to this day, they still revere the man and almost have like a lasting relationship with him and still look up to him. So I guess a question would be to both of you, and Henry, I'll start with you. What made his connection to players so personal and lasting? I know you said, you know, trying to, you know, talk to specific players. Is there anything else that you want to elaborate on that?
Yeah, they all knew, and it was because they all knew that he cared about them. Not just as football players. He did care about them as individuals. He would ask about their families. He would ask how school was going. He would make sure that they were going to class. And as Grant once told me, he said, you just knew that he cared about you a heck of a lot more as a person than he did as a football player. And so it did. He connected with them on a very individual level. And that's and the Grant's second part of that statement was, and that's why we were willing to run through a wall for him. and they were.
Yeah. Brandon, any additional thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think Tom Osborne would maybe tell you, or certainly some of his former players would tell you, that it was kind of the honesty part of it that engenders that deep, deep devotion. I'm sure we can all think of people who are formative in our lives, be they teachers, coaches, et cetera. Like, it's extremely powerful to find somebody who's just invested in you unlocking your potential. And that's good. That's great. It feels amazing. Those are really important experiences. But a lot of football coaches can kind of like get up there and say that's what they're about and believe that's what they're really about. So when I think about that, like, and when I think about Osborne and how he won, and where he stands in college football, kind of like reaching that level between very good and the whatever's above that, it becomes that honesty part of it, because that's kind of the hard piece of it, of being able to tell a player like, hey, I think you're better than you're performing right now. And if you listen, like, or if you follow, you know, listen to your coaches, not just listen to me, Tom Osborne, in this instance, I can help you get there. Or in some cases, it's telling a player like, hey, here's where you really stand. Like, maybe you're not going to play here, but you're welcome to be here. You know, that's kind of like the extra level to it. And I think when you're just that kind of completely straightforward and honest with people, it may not feel that way at the time. Like, there are definitely players who left Nebraska or didn't play much in their careers who are kind of like, I got a raw deal, you know? But I don't think there are many, because the standard was the same all the time of just like, tell people where they actually stand. And yeah, if you do that, it's an increasingly rare commodity.
Yeah.
There were a lot of, you know, under Tom, there were a lot of blowout victories, and those blowout victories were really important, because those were the games where he got all the walk-ons on the field. And, you know, those were the games where you have a guy who spent 4 years, you know, getting beat up on the scout team. And in that fourth quarter against, you know, some directional school, he's going to get to run down on a kickoff And that might be the only play he's going to get in all year. But based on that, he's going to be able to tell his family for the rest of his life, I played for Nebraska football. I played for Tom Osborne.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Definitely.
So with Tom and Grant, we had, I thought it was a pretty good and thoughtful conversation about the Lawrence Phillips situation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I genuinely believe, like, I compared T.O.'s stance to the famous Nick Saban press conference that everyone should find it on YouTube. It's readily available when he's talking about Musin Muhammad. And so he's at Alabama, so he's referencing back to a time when he was at Michigan State, and Muhammad got in trouble. And in Saban's words, at least, everyone wanted to condemn the kid. Everyone wanted him off the team. And Saban suspended him, but then he let him back to the team. And then in his telling at the time, then Saban's saying, I just ran into him. And he's a president of a company. And he played 14 years in the NFL. And he has 9 children. And his daughter's at Princeton. And so where do you want them to be? This is Saban saying, where do you want them to be? Do you want them on the street? Or do you want them running a company while their daughter's going to Princeton? And I love that. It's a very powerful clip from Saban. I encourage everyone to watch it. And I genuinely believe that sort of mindset of what's best for the player and second chances and redemption and all those things are where, like, Tom Osborne came down as well on the Lawrence Phillips thing. It was interesting. Chattel brought up the fact that he wrote at the time, and I believe he was saying, like, he felt Phillips should not have been allowed, like, give him a support system, let him around the team, but he shouldn't have been allowed back on the team. And I think both of those things can be true. I think T.O. could have wanted what's best for the team. And one could make the case that LP should not have been allowed back on the football field ever again. And I said in the episode too, like, I think, you know, maybe that's an argument for those decisions being taken out of coaches' hands, right? Because they are invested in their players. So I think the question has to be asked, even though what I just laid out is kind of where I come down, how much of Osborne's decision was influenced by his belief in redemption and second chances versus the pressure to win a championship?
Well, I mean, it's really hard to get into Tom's head, but, you know, you have to believe that the biggest driver was the second chances and his belief that you just don't give up on kids. But because we can't get in his heads, I've never been willing to completely accept without question that it was a completely selfless act. I mean, there was a heck of a lot riding on that season, and I say this not so much with respect to Tom, but with some of the players on the team. A lot of the players, they would always say to me, we didn't need Lawrence. We didn't need him to win. And I would agree that's true in hindsight. But we didn't know that at the time. Right. We didn't.
Yeah.
There was no knowledge that this fresh, unproven freshman named Amon Green was going to become a star. I mean, everyone knew there was a really tough game against Colorado that was there at the end of the schedule. And I know fans were really hoping, boy, I hope Lawrence is back in time for Colorado. And even going into that national championship game, I mean, they crushed Florida, but did we know that was going to happen? Did anybody know that was going to happen? And maybe Tom did, you know, cause we always know that Tom knew things and knew how things were going to play out more than most other people did. But heck, wasn't even Florida the floor? I can't remember. They may have been the favorite in that game by the bettors. I can't remember. It was, you know, a couple of points one way or the other. I mean, so nobody can just say, oh no, we didn't need him. We would have won without him anyway. You did not know that. There was no clarity to that whatsoever.
Right.
Brandon? Yeah, this one's difficult still all these years later, because I think there's convenient narratives out there. You know, one that Henry, I think, is describing there is like, oh, we didn't need him, which is easy to say after the fact. You know, another one at the time would have been, I guess I still come down on this, and I want to be really careful with this one, you know, because like there was a victim in this incident, as we all know. And, you know, that's, it's hard to just focus on like the football piece of it and the decision-making there. But, I still kind of view removing Lawrence Phillips from the team as the path of least resistance, which kind of goes back to what I was talking about when we started of, I don't find a lot of evidence, at least big picture evidence, like everyone can pull up, you know, individual incidents or things like that of Tom Osborne taking a shortcut. And I don't think allowing Lawrence Phillips to remain around the team with the team and potentially play again was in any way the shortcut. Like, you know, the shortcut would have been taking the tie in the 84 Orange Bowl, you know, to tie it to that. And he didn't do that then either. So I've always kind of viewed it in that light. And, you know, when you look at what happened after that, it's impossible to project what would have happened if he'd made the opposite decision. But it's one of those things where at the time, and, you know, I remember having these conversations with people, not necessarily at the time, but after the fact. I remember one specifically with a Michigan alum. We were talking about 1997 and split title, and then that led to Lawrence Phillips somehow of like, you know, if you're not deeply embedded in the Nebraska thing, if you're not a Nebraska fan, like it's completely easy to be like, oh, I was just all about winning, like win at all costs. And I don't think Osborne's history and track record supports that view all that strongly. Is kind of the roundabout way. Like I said, it's still complicated all these years later. But that's kind of where I've always stood.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So whether you need to hire 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
And I know, having talked, I mean, I've talked to Tom about this subject for literally for hours over the years. And I do know he feels he made the best decision he could with what information he had at the time and with what he thought was Lawrence's best interest at heart. And what he knew was also included an internal university investigation that did not kick Lawrence out of school. He remained a student in standing at the university. And that was after an internal investigation. And I think if that investigation had turned out differently, I don't think you would have. I think clearly you would not have seen Lawrence Phillips back on the football field again. But he acted on what he knew and what he thought was best. And he really made the decision, I think, that only Tom Osborne could make.
Brandon, you actually asked the question that I was going to ask was, having hindsight, and you know, I know it's a touchy subject. We better be as respectful as possible. But knowing how things turned out with LP after Nebraska, Henry, I would ask you, having that benefit of hindsight now, do you think T.O. would have done anything differently?
I'm not sure he would. I mean, again, we've hashed this out a lot, and I haven't seen any indication that he's ever indicated that. Other than him saying that it would have been easier to boot him. And, yeah.
I don't know that in hindsight he would call it a mistake.
Got it.
What about, do you think that Osborne's loyalty to Phillips or to other, I mean, other players got in trouble while Tom was the coach too in the 70s and the 80s. And I think the magnifying glass, so to speak, just got way bigger in the 90s. So that's kind of what everyone focuses on. But do you think that loyalty to the players reflects a strength of character or a blind spot or both of those things?
I go back to something Henry said very early on in this conversation. Like, I think it's mostly just a reflection of his belief in people and not just a willingness to believe that you can help or do good by giving people a chance at redemption. But with Osborne, I always got the sense that that was more something he viewed as a duty. So, you know, I'll never forget in the 80s, Armin Katan, I'm forgetting his co-writer, very good journalist, put out a book, Big Red Confidential, which was kind of like the expose, intended to be the expose of Nebraska. And like, I was coming to it, you know, 20 years later, like the first time I learned about it, and it was kind of getting into media, and I read it and I was kind of like, okay, like, yeah, there's some stuff here, but like, I kind of felt like there wasn't a ton there. It felt like some real digging, something that was more driven by a book proposal than what was actually there. And now, you know, I haven't read that book in a long time. And like I said, I respect those, the Armin Katan in particular, a ton. They put in the work and did it. But I was just kind of like, you know, if that's what we're talking about, like, you can find those examples at a lot of places, which isn't to give Nebraska or anybody else a pass. I was just kind of like, well, if this is what we're talking about, and if you have a good idea of, you know, who we think Tom Osborne is, I don't know. Like, you know, it's one of those. Yeah, go ahead.
I actually know the history of that book. Armin Katan was sent to Lincoln by Sports Illustrated to do a takeout on, I mean, their idea was they wanted to show that college football is just the most corrupt enterprise out there. And just to prove it, we're going to send this reporter to this, you know, to this program run by this pious guy in Lincoln. We're just going to show that the whole thing is corrupt. And they should have
kept heading south to Norman. Anyway, go ahead.
maybe that was too easy, right? Exactly. And he spent weeks in holed up in a hotel reporting and digging and trying, you know, and as I recall, the best thing he found was that, yeah, there may have been a player that used steroids, you know, or two, but it wasn't like there was the team was injecting players with steroids or condoning it or any, I mean, he came up with very little. And that's how it became a book, because he had spent all this time reporting. And when he got back to Sports Illustrated, they said, man, there's not a story here. So it wasn't a story. So he turned it into a book.
Wow. That's incredible. All right. Well, let's talk about some what ifs. I mean, I think Jen, you have to be like, you know, a Michigan fan or like somebody, like, you have to be, I think, skewed. I mean, I don't know, maybe this is a big red colored glasses, but I think his character over many decades, his commitment to his players, like, the record is clear on all of those things. Did, you know, was every decision the right decision? I think that's for people to discuss and debate forever and for history to decide. But I think everything he did was, we talked about this, was driven by his belief in his players, driven by his faith, driven by any number of things. And I think his character was on display. You know, I think that has stood the test of time. Let's pivot a little bit. I want to talk about some what ifs. Bring up Nick Saban again. He's getting way too much run on this.
Yeah, what are you doing?
Session.
What are we doing? But,
Saban was 72 when he retired from being the head coach at Alabama. T.O. was only 60 when he announced his retirement in 1997. what if we love doing the what if game on this podcast. We did a whole what if series last summer. What if T.O. had coached 12 more years? That would take us all the way to 2009. I open it up to the group. Henry, Brandon, I'd love to hear both of your thoughts on this. What do you guys think? Brandon, let's start with you on this one.
Yeah, Brandon's the football guy.
Well, I mean, the thing that jumps out to me about that is, like, it basically takes Nebraska to the precipice of the Big Ten era, which would have been a convenient, you know, stopping point as well. And, you know, at some of the past places we worked, or I worked, you know, we did some digging on after the fact. Well, it was for the 10-year anniversary of Nebraska being in the Big Ten. We did a story on talking to some of the assistant coaches, kind of high-profile guys who were still coaching, and, you know, John Papuchis, Tim Beck, the coordinators then, talking about that move to the Big Ten, and they were like, it was harder than anybody, like, anybody had any idea. And so that stands out to me, and I think that still would have been the case. But in terms of continuing on basically through the 2000s almost, like, I think Nebraska remains a factor in the Big 12, particularly with that division set up. There would have been changes. Like, the biggest challenges to this question in particular of kind of trying to envision 12 more years is like, well, how much is the game going to change? And how is offense and defense going to change? And, you know, that coaching staff had been together for a long time. There would have been a lot more turnover on the coaching staff than they had had to deal with to that point. And anytime you do that, it inserts some uncertainty into things, certainly. But I think you can look at it pretty fairly. And, you know, so Bo Pelini comes along in 2008. That's almost the cutoff point too. You avoid the Callahan era. You probably lose Solich to another head coaching job someplace else.
Brandon, can I just, you said it right there. No matter what TJ's, no matter how many alternate timelines you want to put out there, TJ, you can't avoid the Callahan era. It happened. It's here to stay. I'm sorry. Stop it, Jeff. Stop it. Go ahead, Brandon. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I think that's it. I mean, I think they remain a factor, you know, for a long time. Even without Osborne, Nebraska was kind of almost a de facto favorite in the North, just by the way it was set up. I think that would have been more solidified if he continues coaching.
Yeah. I just have to think he would have had a Saban-like run, the kind of run that Saban had through the, you know, in this millennium. I mean, I have no doubt he would have won more national championships. I mean, look, in 99,
yep,
were it not for a Correll Buckhalter fumble at the goal line, they're national champions under Solich that year. You don't think Tom would have found a way to win, you know, win that game? At 2001, you know, they got to the national championship game. Now they were kind of lucky to get there. But, you know, that's a team that was on the fumes of this was the last team that had a lot of upper class players that were Tom Osborne recruits. You know, the recruiting, we know, really fell off. Well, if recruiting hadn't fallen off, what does the 2001 team look like? You know, I bet you it has a lot of standout sophomores and that we never ever got to know. I'll bet you they would have committed. I would concede that they would have taken a step back in 98 because they lost so many guys off that 97 team. But I have to think that next 5 years he would have done some major damage. And then beyond that, it gets a little harder to project. We know the Big 12 kind of became more of a kind of a run and gun kind of league. And how would he adapt it to that? I think there are some questions there, but he was a great coach. I just think he would have found a way. I think he would have put up a record that no one would have ever touched.
Oh.
Speculation, but yeah. Informed speculation,
well,
I think.
Well, let's keep going with the hypotheticals.
Another time.
You know, there are elements of Tom Osborne's offense in a lot of modern college football in the way that plays are called and play design. But I'll leave this to Brandon. This seems like a question right up his alley. Do you think Osborne's version of the option eventually migrates to more of like what Chip Kelly was doing at Oregon, kind of that kind of style of offense? Do you think it stays as simplistic as it was, stays the same, or do you think he does something completely different? And again, this is totally like alternate universe hypothetical.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely where things go. Well, not absolutely, but something close to that. You know, when I look at trying to continue this for 12 years, maybe the biggest challenge to just kind of ongoing excellence for Tom Osborne during that era is you're going to run out of like true option quarterbacks. And with where we know college football's headed during that era, like you're starting to see the spread offense, like dual threats, a different name, but it's also a different quarterback than an option. Like they just stopped running it at the high school level, essentially. And in Nebraska, you know, particularly later in the Osborne era, basically has its pick of those because who else is still running the option at that level the way that they were. But I look back at the playbooks from 96 and 97. Nebraska had 14 base formations. Seven of those were not I formation. They were trips variations. They were shotgun. They were no back. They were ace. So like a lot of that stuff was already there. And, you know, this kind of takes us back to, you know, where we started with the episode of the 60s when Osborne became the OC of like, that's kind of where he came from. Like the option was an adaptation to what he was seeing in the Big Eight at the time. And if we think of Nebraska offense as just like the I formation and, you know, that's what they do, it kind of wasn't that, particularly by the time we get to 96, 97. So I feel with pretty good confidence that things would have continued to evolve and, you know, it would have been a little early for this, but we look at kind of the run pass option RPO era that we're in now. It's like, if you could have Tom Osborne design those plays right now, you'd probably take it because, you know, it's just instead of pitching it backwards, you get to throw it forwards now.
Yeah. Some 6'6" tight end just running wide open down the middle of the field. Somehow T.O. would have that drawn up.
Love it.
Henry, anything else on that?
No, not really. I mean, I know, you know, he's a student of the game, you know, even when he's out of coaching, you know, I heard him talk about Urban Meyer's offense and that he was running at Florida. I once heard him say, boy, can you imagine Tommy Frazier in the zone read? You know, I think he would have, you know, adapted to that. I think he probably would have been running zone read as the game adapted in that way. I think, you know, what Urban won two titles at Florida, you know, with a running quarterback, and you know, this was almost a decade after Tom was retired. So I think there was there was still an opportunity for a run first offense in that era.
Gotcha. I think I already know the answer to this question because it comes up all the time, but college football and just how things operate now is so different in the NIL era. Just everything is all over the place. And you always hear people, especially the diehard purists for Nebraska football, saying like, you know, we missed the walk-on program. We need to develop these players. That's Nebraska in its glory days. We need to go back to that. And I think I know what the answer is probably going to be from both of you, but I still got to ask it from the pros. Can a college coach today still succeed at the highest level with the old school development focused approach, or has the NIL era and the transfer portal and all of those things made that virtually impossible? Brandon, what do you think?
I think in Nebraska, well, I guess to start, like, we're still figuring this out because like the transfer portal feels like it's been around for a while now, but it's still relatively new. So there's that piece of it, but I think in a place like Nebraska, where the natural recruiting resources and even the recruiting's changing too, are what they are and really aren't drastically different from what they were from the Osborne era in terms of proximity to high level players. You always have to be about development to win consistently at a place like Nebraska. I think the thing that's become different is that sort of commitment to development has become almost more of a luxury. In that, you know, we think back to, say, 1996, 97, like, or even beyond that, you could identify the programs that are about development. Like, we can still kind of do it. Iowa's a development program. Wisconsin under Barry Alvarez was a development program. Nebraska 100% was, you know, for a very long time, because they kind of had to be. Now, you don't necessarily have to be. But I think it's dangerous once you get on kind of the, we're a transfer portal team, or, you know, it becomes kind of a hamster wheel that becomes difficult to get off. And maybe, again, it's still early, like Florida State post 2023, when it was, you know, a playoff team minus a unfortunate quarterback injury, to how far they fell in 2024. Well, now they've tried to address all that stuff, and we'll see. And they took Nebraska's offensive coordinator and its D-line coach and a couple of its good defensive players. And if they're right on those, well, then they can get back there. But a lot of those guys will then be gone again. Yeah. So I kind of look at the development piece of it. It's gotten harder, but I don't think it's impossible. I still think, and when I think about it from a Nebraska lens, I still think it's pretty much essential.
Yeah, I think we're going to see a little bit of that, you know, perhaps this year with Coach Rhule. I spoke to him a couple of years ago about how Tom had rubbed off on him, and it was very clear. It's summed up in one word, not even a complete word, reps. Tom impressed upon him the importance of reps and practice and getting everybody reps and practice, including the second stringers and the third stringers. And Rhule didn't run four stations because he didn't have the players, but Rod Brown told me they were running three, you know, and they were trying to get reps for everybody. And I don't know how much that has changed in the last 2 years because of, you know, we know the roster isn't as big anymore. And but I think Rhule had committed to being a developmental program. And a lot of those players they're developing are some of the players that are supposed to be stepping up this year. And so maybe we'll get a chance to see how well this is going to work. The four station thing, that when I, the first time I sat down with Tom for that book and he explained the practice and the four station thing, and it just made so much sense. You know, it's just like the second stringers were getting just as many reps as the first stringers. So someone was able to step in if somebody got hurt or somebody graduated, and the third and fourth stringers, even though they were doing scout stuff, they're at least, you know, out there blocking and tackling and doing the things that you do. And, you know, it was, I would say after I remember saying to him, I mean, you guys were a true football factory. And I mean that in the best sense of the word. You knew how to produce football players. And I still think there has to be an element of that still in the game.
Yeah, and that's a good point. Like, Dylan Raiola is a developmental player. He's a work in progress. So we're still developing players as we speak right now. So
yeah. Well, and I think certain position groups are just naturally more developmental, right? Like offensive line, you're not going to go and pluck, you know, some starting offensive lineman out of the portal every single year. That's just a position where you're better off getting guys in and having them have 2, 3, 4 years in the program before they're starters. So I think Nebraska really has to live in both worlds. Right. Mm-hmm. You gotta still have to do the development, but you do need to go and get, you know, like a Dane Key or somebody like that, or some skill players just to fill some holes.
Yeah, for sure.
I've got one more. We'll end on one more somewhat serious question. But before I get to that, Henry, I want to ask you in particular, as we've done research for this series, we've seen a lot of old pictures, and I'm curious, like T.O. back in the day would rock the red pants. He'd have kind of the you know, the athletic fit polos, you know, like he was looking pretty sleek on the sideline. And then when you get into the 90s, you're a little more conservatively dressed, shall we say. Did you ever talk to him about the evolution of his wardrobe?
No.
All right, well,
I'm sorry I let you down on that. Yeah.
That's okay. So I've got one final question, guys. I think, you know, let's be clear, none of us would trade the success that Devaney and Osborne brought the program, of course. And it was really decades of excellence, decades of even dominance. I'm curious what you guys think, though, like, what has been the impact of that standard on all the coaches that have come after? And as Nebraska sort of fell out of, sort of lost their way, so to speak, has it become more and more of a burden?
My thinking on this is it's somewhat changed fairly recently. And I think, you know, maybe it's just me changing my mind. Maybe it's influenced by the changes in college football. But, and I've written about this a handful of times, like the historical record shows that, you know, these quote unquote blue blood programs all kind of go through their swoons, and they almost always pull out of them eventually. And in some ways it became a self-fulfilling prophecy of like, expectations are what eventually allow you to meet expectations again, because there's no other option. Enough has changed with the game now that, and some of this is a little bit of recency bias too, which is the last decade-ish we've seen from Nebraska football. But there have been times where I wondered where, you know, if you're a Nebraska football player in 2022 and you're headed for 4-8, everything feels as big as it did in like 1996. The facilities are good. You walk by 3 Heisman trophies every day and 5 national championship trophies. And like, I don't mean this as a negative in any way. It's just the reality of it. There's 50 media members at every practice. And most importantly, the stadium is full every Saturday. And at a certain point, if everything feels like as big as it always was, you're just not winning at that level. Does it become a burden? I still hesitate to use that word. Like, it's not bad to have expectations and unrivaled fan support in any way. But I do think it becomes, the burden gets a little bit heavier as the longer Nebraska goes without kind of steering out of whatever it has been in. And meanwhile, while that's happening, college football is changing drastically. I think the playing field generally is leveled when you look at roster limits, revenue sharing, all of these things, you know, that I'm sure you guys have talked about multiple times on other episodes. So yeah, I'm kind of in a, like, if you'd asked me 5 years ago, I'd say no way. Like, the standard is the standard, and well, it's a Matt Rhule quote, I guess. I've incepted it or something. And it's a good thing, ultimately. It's only recently where I've come to think, well, maybe the sport has changed enough that it can become difficult.
Oh. Henry? I don't know that the burden has gotten heavier as longer it's gotten. I think it's probably gotten lighter. I mean, the burden was heaviest on Frank Solich, following right in Tom Osborne's wake. I mean, the expectation was you will be playing for national championships. And let's face it, it's been a quarter century and that has not happened. I think it is both. It is both a burden and a beacon, because there is evidence it has been done here before, and it happened in a couple of different eras here before. It happened in a college football of like unlimited scholarships, and Nebraska was successful. And that happened in an era where everything was really strongly policed in scholarship limits. And it seemed like the scholarship limits were set with Nebraska in mind. And I mean, right after Nebraska, I think it was like right after the 95 season, I think maybe that's when scholarships got cut another 10, you know, at that time. You know, it's just like, it's almost like it was intended to knock Nebraska down a peg. So it's succeeded in kind of a Wild West era where there were no limitations, and it succeeded when it was pretty regimented. And it seems like we're now heading back to a little bit to the Wild West again. Maybe it can be done here again. I'm certainly not going to say it can't.
We started with
I just want to throw in there that Henry is exactly right about this. I looked at this fairly recently, and I won't bore everyone with like breaking down all the numbers, but at counterread.com, looking at kind of like a 30-year run compared to like the next 10 years. And, you know, I was like, I just wonder if there's been teams like Nebraska before. And there was like a Pitt team, you know, there was a lot of teams that kind of dropped off post-World War II, which was certainly a massive change to everything, including college football. Pitt, Minnesota were in there. But the closest one was Nebraska. Like, you know, going into the Bill Jennings era, leading up to Bob Devaney. So in that sense, like, can Nebraska ever get back to what it was? Well, they did it once. Wow. So there's at least that.
It's a great way to end, Brandon. We started with T.S. Eliot. We'll end with Zach Bryan. There's a quote from a Zach Bryan song, "Let's Pretend There's a Place to Go Where I Can Lay This Hacksaw Down." For Nebraska football, that place doesn't exist. There is no respite. The only way out is through. The only way out is back to the top. Yep. All right.
And
anyway,
I'll quote George McFly, Husker fans. if you put your mind to it, you can accomplish anything.
Yes.
There we go.
Yes, Jeffrey. I think that started with Dr. Emmett L. Brown. Didn't Doc Brown say that first?
He might have. Yeah. Yeah, that tracks. He goes all the way back in time, picks it up from him, tells his dad, the rest is history. We know what happens.
That's right. Henry, Brandon, any final thoughts? Another fantastic discussion.
This has been great.
Matty O, Geoff, anything?
No, thank you both for coming on. This has been awesome.
Yes, thank you guys. Appreciate it. It's been a ton of fun.
Well, and that concludes the TO series, Common Fans. Hope you've enjoyed the ride. If you haven't caught all the episodes, again, please go back and find them on the YouTube channel or commonfan.co or anywhere anywhere you get your podcasts on the audio platforms. And now we pivot, boys. Now we start looking ahead to 2025. It's all coming back. It's all here. Can't wait. Can't wait for the Huskers to be in the playoff. It starts now. Tomorrow starts now, friends.
Yeah, that's right.
We'll be back at you very soon, Common Fans. In the meantime, as always, GBR for life.